This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I am a host of New Books in Ukrainian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Christopher Merrill, author of On the Road to Lviv, published by Aerosmith Press in 2023, and the book was translated in Ukrainian by Nina Murray. Christopher Merrill is an American poet, essayist, journalist, and translator. Currently, he serves as director of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. He led the initiative that resulted in the selection of Iowa City as a UNESCO City of Literature, a part of the Creative Cities Network. In 2011, he was appointed to the U.S. National Commission for UNESCO. Hello, Christopher. Thank you so much for joining me today, and thank you so much for the book.
Thank you, Natalia. It's a joy to be with you today.
So I would describe On the Road to Lviv as a poem, but please correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. And if I read it as a poem, it follows and records the developments of the Russo-Ukrainian war, and it absorbs and responds to what we call narratives that circulate around the war. And at the latter level, the text gets more personal, and at the same time, more detached from the narrator. In spite of encompassing multiple sub-narratives, the title of the book, On the Road to Lviv, and it might sound as if there is a final destination at which the narrator wants to arrive. Would you talk about this journey that is encoded in the title, and what does The Road to Lviv mean to you?
Well, thank you for that excellent summation of what the book hopes to do. I think of it as a blank verse meditation on Adam Zagajewski's famous poem, To Go to the Wall, on cultural diplomacy, which is something that I practice as a function of my job at the International Writing Program, and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The poem began in 2006 on my first cultural diplomacy mission to Ukraine. And the circumstances are rather funny in the sense that I was being driven west from Kyiv to Lviv. It was incredibly cold, and I was in an unheated van, and the cultural affairs specialist from the U.S. Embassy, who was in charge of my trip, for some reason the van was unheated, and every few minutes she would roll the window down, I think perhaps because she was experiencing hot flashes in menopause. And I was in the back with another Ukrainian writer, and we were so cold that we ended up taking all of our clothes out of our suitcases and covering ourselves because these hot flashes kept coming. And I was so cold, I was shaking. And at a certain point, I started thinking about Adam's poem, which is such a beautiful poem, remembering the city of his birth that he really didn't see again until he was much older. And some of those lines were coming through my head. And so I began taking notes as we were continuing west. And those notes seemed to be falling into the rhythm of a blank verse, a meter I like to write in. And so I kept picking away at it. And when that mission was complete and I came home, from time to time, I would write a little more on those lines, never really confident that it would go anywhere, but that I found something in the music of, and the memory of that journey west congenial to the writing of more verses. I made a second cultural diplomacy mission to Ukraine in 2015, not long after the Russian invasion of the eastern Ukraine and occupation of Crimea. And by then, of course, the stakes were a lot different, and I was taking notes in a different frame of mind, I think would be the best way to phrase it. And I kept adding lines here and there as the years went on. Adam Zagajewski came back into my mind. I was always thinking about his poems and his prose, such a wonderful poet he was. And for some reason, not long before he passed away, I began thinking about him again and remembering events with him, particularly a reading at a literary festival in Slovenia. And so I kept writing lines. And then, of course, the Russians invaded Ukraine. As it happened, it was on the day of my 65th birthday, which, of course, is a big moment in somebody's life. And I felt compelled to keep trying. I felt compelled to bear witness in some fashion within that larger framework of the poem that I had undertaken with no expectations of anything many, many years before. And then, of course, the viciousness of the war, of the invasion, the terrible things that were happening kept coming to mind, and I would find myself desperately trying to write about them in the hope of making sense of this, it seems to me, history-changing tragedy that's unfolding before our very eyes. What's interesting about all this is that I am not unfamiliar with war zones. I covered the wars of succession in the former Yugoslavia. I wrote two prose books about those wars. I wrote another book that had to do with a small war in Lebanon. So I've been in these kinds of places, and I never actually thought about writing poetry in any of those settings. When I was writing about the wars in the former Yugoslavia, I was always saying to myself that Bosnian poets should be writing about this. I shouldn't write poetry. I will just document. This time around, I felt compelled to write poetry, and that's how the lines kept coming until at a certain point I realized this seems to feel like a book. And so that's what we have before us. And I'm very grateful to Nina Murray for translating the poem in its entirety, and to Askel Melnicek, the publisher of Arrowsmith Press, to agree to publish both the original English version of the poem along with the translation. It's a unique way to put a book together, and I'm hoping that it will mean something to some readers here and in Ukraine.
Thank you. So I would like to take a sub road toward our conversation. You mentioned that you had two missions of cultural diplomacy to Ukraine, and one was before the war, and another one was right after 2014, which is considered to be the first stage of the Russo-Ukrainian war today. So you had this pre-war experience. Would you just briefly describe what your mission was and what your immediate observations were? Because it does sound like you had a very immediate experience of what the country is and how the actual developments were taking place.
Yeah, well, the cultural diplomacy was undertaken at the behest of the U.S. State Department, and the first mission is kind of funny. The program I run, the International Writing Program, is funded to a considerable extent by the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs at the U.S. Department of State, and so it's not unusual for me to go out as a cultural envoy to different places. The first mission to Ukraine was kind of funny because I got an email from somebody I knew at that time not very well at the State Department, and the subject line of the the email was your journey to Kyiv, and I, or actually Kiev as it was pronounced in 2006, at least for Americans. And I, he said, it said, call me. And so I called that number and I thought, what journey to Kiev are you talking about? And he said, oh, you're going, you're going in 3 days. I said, what? So, but, I packed quickly and I flew there. And the idea in any cultural diplomacy mission, at least as I understand it, is an exchange of ideas and opinions and information between people in a people-to-people exchange, right? So the first time I went by myself, and yeah, and in fact, it was wonderful to be in Ukraine at the time. Cool as it was, I live in Iowa, which is a pretty cold state as well, but I don't think I've ever been quite as cold as I was that first winter in 2006. I was coming not long after the Orange Revolution, so one of the things that I noticed as we were driving westward, all these orange banners in different places, and I thought, oh, that's quite interesting. And the second mission took place, again, as you say, not long after the Russian invasion, and on that one, I brought some American writers with me, Elliot Ackerman, a terrific nonfiction writer and novelist who served in Afghanistan and Iraq as a soldier, and has since gone on to write some really fantastic books, both in fiction and nonfiction. A poet named Jeffrey Brown, who is better known in the United States as the cultural correspondent for the NewsHour, the public broadcasting services daily news program. He's also a terrific poet, and the writer Jennifer Kropp, who's a novelist and translator of Polish writings. And we spent time in Kyiv, and then we went up to Kharkiv and had events there. So when the invasion began in 2022, and Kharkiv particularly was getting pummeled, I thought all I could think about was the places that I went in the university and the Museum of Natural History and notes that I had taken during that journey in 2015 now seemed to have a different kind of meaning in my imagination, and that was part of what I ended up trying to write about, was what those places looked like before the war, and then trying to imagine what it must feel like in the aftermath. I spent a lot of time in Sarajevo during that earlier war, so I know something about the terror that comes when you're under siege and when there's missiles flying all around you, something I've written about in prose. So in some ways, I think that in this book, I was trying to imagine my way into the lives of ordinary Ukrainians via my own experience of a different war back in the 1990s, a war, I might add, that seems in so many ways to be a pretty accurate prophecy of what was going to be going on now in the Russo-Ukrainian war.
Maybe it would be correct to put it this way, that in many ways wars are the same, but at the same time, each war is quite different from others. And since you have all these previous experiences of covering wars, how would you summarize the similarities and differences in terms of, let's say, this current Russia's war against Ukraine? What is it that is probably helpful to others to understand what's going on the ground, but on the other hand, what are those specific things that would prevent us from putting everything under one umbrella of just violence, and in this way somehow blurring the pain of the individuals who are actually experiencing these tragedies on a daily basis?
That's a really terrific question, and in some ways unanswerable, but I'll take a stab at some of it. Every war, of course, is different from every other war, but it is the case that wonderful line that truth is the first casualty of war. That's very much the case in this war, of course, Vladimir Putin creates this fiction that Ukraine is a Nazi state, even though its president is Jewish. The relentless repetition of these kinds of lies, what in America we have come to call the big lie, in the service of some means of trying to maintain power or to conquer another place, propaganda is absolutely essential to that. It's those terrible acts. And in my mind, what writers do is always at their best in the service of truth. It's different kinds of truth telling that one engages in if you are a writer. And I felt that when I was covering the war in the former Yugoslavia, when I would find myself in a conversation with somebody and I would realize that I was unconsciously begun to parrot certain arguments I heard from one side or another, that was always the signal to me to get to the other side, to try to understand, to balance my perspective. In this case, it's you know, when you have 190,000 troops massed on the border and you're hearing one lie after another, you realize that this is the stakes are very much higher. The casualty count, of course, is going to be much, much higher than what happened in the Balkans. And you'll see some of the same kinds of paralyzed responses by political leaders that you hope would act better. Fortunately, in this case, I think President Biden immediately understood the larger implications of what this war would mean for the Western world, for the cause of freedom, for the basic idea respecting a nation's sovereignty. All of those are under attack. And I think he acted quite well, quite decisively to counteract that and to create a coalition of forces against what Putin was trying to do. But you still hear the other arguments keep arising to try to distract Americans from the continuing obligation to fund and to support the Ukrainian army and the Ukrainian cause. In the Balkans in the 1990s, the issue was here was a beautiful city in Sarajevo that had just hosted the Winter Olympics, and 8 years later it was about to undergo the longest siege in modern history, longer even than the siege of Leningrad, and that at the time seemed like the central cause of the time. Even so, I remember talking to the great New York Times reporter John Burns, who won a Pulitzer for some of his reporting on the war in the former Yugoslavia, and he said to me two things that I have always kept in mind. One, he said, this story, and he pointed to the mountains surrounding Sarajevo where the Serbian forces were arrayed, this story writes itself. And the second thing he said was that the New York Times, he was the Times bureau chief in Sarajevo at the time, had done a poll of its readers and discovered that something like 19% of the readers were reading the articles, the Burns's articles on the war in Bosnia, and particularly the siege of Sarajevo. And I thought to myself, we imagine the New York Times readership to be the most sophisticated, the most current in the U.S., but if less than 1 in 5 Americans were reading these stories that, to my mind, were central to whatever the new world order was going to come to resemble, I thought that we're really in for trouble. And that's the cause of truth is always at the mercy of skilled propagandists, skilled fiction writers. So the stakes are considerably higher now than they were back in the 1990s. But the fallout is just the same. I also think back to the 1990s, I, like so many people that do, were covering that war, were always arguing for the U.S. government to arm the Bosnians so they could defend themselves. And, you know, they kept on holding off. And then finally, in the summer of 1995, the Serbs massacre 8,000 men and boys at Srebrenica. And at that point, the scale of war criminality is so great that they have to engage. And in short order, with the help of cruise missiles and some targeted airstrikes, they pretty much brought the war to an end in a couple of weeks. And I remember driving out of Sarajevo in December of that year, after the Dayton Peace Accords had been signed, and I was with a humanitarian. We passed we were entering a Serbian village, and in the middle of this village was one in the central part of the town. One building looked like spaghetti. It was a command and control center, and everything around it was fine, untouched. And the humanitarian said to me, just look at that. That's what one cruise missile did. Imagine if that had happened 3 years ago, which tens of thousands of people would not have lost their lives. It feels sort of like the same, where it's up to like the same situation now with arming the Ukrainian army with F-16s and different kinds of cruise missiles with a larger radius to get into Crimea proper and into Russia. I understand all the arguments against it, but I also understand, I have a historical memory of how long it took us, the West, to rally the last time when ethnic cleansing was underway in the Balkans. And in that way, I see these similarities. And those are the kinds of things that keep me awake at night.
I really appreciate how you put all kinds of texts, well, let's put it this way, together. And by texts, I mean ideas, opinions, what we call narratives, discourses, facts. I would like to read out just a very short a fragment from the poem. It's page 12. The Kremlin promises a military and technical alternative if Ukraine refuses to kowtow to Russian demands, to sign away its own security and, by extension, the West's raison d'etre ideals and democratic rhetoric. Only a fool or traitor would support surrendering without firing a shot, and we are flush with both like every nation. Pity the scholar who can't imagine why Russian hypersonic carrier killers may be unleashed in the first strike. And if it is, a military planner schooled in the Kremlin strategy explains that it will be game over for the West and possibly all of civilization. And the whole poem focuses on history, and as you pointed out, there are a lot of references to history, not only on a broader collective level, but on a personal level as well. As you pointed out, history is kind of a driving force to some extent of this war, particularly as the Kremlin keeps escalating all kinds of narratives that are genocidal in its nature right now. So my question is, what is history in your opinion, and how you approach history? Because what Putin did to history was that he completely, to some extent, subverted the very word. But by engaging in his rhetoric, maybe we do, to some extent, give some weight, or we validate his words to some extent, but not to engage with that kind of rhetoric will also be, I would say, not quite fair, and it would be very hard to justify why would one be quiet and not respond to that kind of narrative about Ukrainians not being a real people or a real nation distinct from Russian. So how do we deal with history today? How do you approach history when you write about this war?
Yeah, well, that's again another wonderful question. Your obligation, in my view, as a writer, is to get the facts straight. And in the case of this book, I'm trying to give voice to different people, both the propagandists and ordinary citizens, in the service of what I hope will be a larger truth. And that means being available to lots of voices, making sure that there are different kinds of voices operating within the poem, but taking care to make sure that I don't subscribe in any way to propaganda on any side. I'm trying to feel my way forward, understanding that history is probably in every sense it is a matter of storytelling, and there are some storytellers are better than others because they pledge allegiance to the facts and because they try to understand the totality of the experience. Here's one way I think about it. When I wrote the book, Only the Nails Remain, Scenes from the Balkan Wars, there are several kind of funny passages because in Sarajevo, for example, I'd probably never heard more jokes than when I was in Sarajevo. And of course, people tell jokes to pass the time, but also to let off steam. It's a pressure valve, a kind of release. And so I thought, when I'm writing this book, I need to make sure that I include the humor, that I give readers a sense of the totality of what that experience is all about. Because it's in those particulars, those concrete details, and those jokes and storytelling that you engage in, you start to get a glimpse of that larger truth, and that's the ways in which, you know, if truth is the first casualty of war, then it's the writer's responsibility to find ways to get at that truth. And of course, it's a casualty of war because the propagandists have much larger platforms than a lowly poet in the United States, right?
I would like to talk a little bit about violence and this concept of violence that is present in your poem as well. Although it's not through some direct engagement, right, with some philosophical explanation what it means and how it impacts the individual or the humankind, but rather through some specific events, through specific facts. And it's page 64. The reconstruction of the theater bombing in Mariupol estimated that at least 600 citizens were killed that day in March in what investigators concluded was not only the most heinous war crime in the first months of the invasion, but the most visible in modern warfare. What a set designer had inscribed the word children in the white paint on the pavement outside the entrances in front and back in Cyrillic, letters large enough for satellites to register and journalists to broadcast around the world, and Russian pilots to read before they followed their orders, bombs away. So there is a local, so to speak, level of the war when mothers, for instance, are trying to save their children, and there is a global level. The NATO stance on the war, for instance, the negotiations between the West and Ukraine in terms of military and humanitarian aid, as well as the West's ongoing hopes to establish some sort of dialogue with Kremlin even today. There is an attempt to show the gap of a war perception that is experienced by individual people who wants to protect their children and the imaginary political players that don't seem to relate to the pain of the mother, for instance, who wants to just save her child from the violence of a Russian soldier. Would you elaborate on how the nature of violence that shocked many after Russian troops left Bucha, and how violence is articulated by those who are its targets and those who do not participate, those who sympathize, but do not seem to undertake all measures possible to stop the violence and punish the perpetrators?
Excellent question. It's part of the inspiration to write this poem was to, on the most basic level, document what was going on so as not to forget the early days of the invasion and what sorts of things were being reported on in major media around the world and in my conversations with Ukrainian writers, et cetera. So I felt compelled to document as much as I could, particularly because violence tends to make, at a certain point, one gets numb to the effects of it in the same way that one becomes numb to the ways in which propaganda normalizes vicious behavior. And again, what a writer seeks to do at their best, I think, is to puncture that feeling of numbness so that we are alert again to what it is that's going on in different places, and particularly when war crimes are being committed. And the war crimes that have been documented so extensively after Bucha and Kherson and in various other places, there can be no doubt that the validity of the claims about these war crimes, that evidence needs to be analyzed, gathered, analyzed, documented, so that at some point down the road, we hope there will be justice for at least some of the victims of this tragedy. And so, you know, we have to be alert to what the violence is all about. You know, when a Russian pilot sees the word children and still releases the bombs under orders, they're ordered to do such a thing, but it's a kind of savagery that if it were to happen to their own children, they would be as horrified as anyone would be. And so I sought in that passage in the poem to put together all the different ways of approaching that word, to set designers and think, what can we do? How can we save our children? Well, we'll put that sign. We'll scratch out that sign so that anybody could see it. It's also the case that satellites will register it, and thus it can be cataloged as part of the inventory of war crimes that investigators and prosecutors will later use to bring justice to that situation. And then journalists are also writing it and filming it and photographing it, all different ways of trying to put to juxtapose the heinous act of Russian pilots bombing a civilian structure where children are hiding, and the larger war at hand.
Do you believe that there is an effective way of speaking about war so that, the pain of those who are directly affected by it would be delivered in a proper way, but on the other hand, those who are not directly affected could somehow sympathize? And I'm asking this question because particularly after the first 2, 3, 4 months when the full-scale invasion started, to an extent, it was easier to talk about personal experiences because people would sympathize. But then gradually the conversation moved toward statements like, well, I understand the war is a very emotional event for you, but the war is complicated and we have to take some balanced position so that we hear the viewpoints from both sides. And in this way, the perpetrators become also participants of the dialogue. And so this kind of change made me think about whether it's possible to find this effective way which can still state clearly who the perpetrator is and who the victim is, and how these kind of conversation, even if it's not a dialogue, but this kind of conversation can be conducted in the way when the perpetrators do not become victims as well.
Yeah. Well, that's at the heart of truth-telling. And I know that when I covered the war in the former Yugoslavia, I remember the strange feeling of being in a city under siege for weeks at a time, scared all the time, and then getting on a UNHCR flight to, let's say, Ancona, Italy, or Split, Croatia, and being in the so-called West, 100 miles away from concentration camps, and life just goes on as usual, right? And people mostly are keen to turn away from the most gruesome aspects of life. That's just the nature of it. Here's another way to think about it. 15 years ago here in Iowa City, we had a catastrophic flood, a 500-year flood, which did about $1 billion worth of damage, destroyed the arts campus of the University of Iowa, where I work. And at one point, it was common that people went, this citizen of Iowa City went there. We were filling sandbags and putting them up to try to save things. There was you could find on YouTube videos, hundreds of people taking books out of the library to save them from being flooded. And I took my then teenage daughter with me. One day we were sandbagging all morning, and then when we were too tired to keep going, we drove home, but it was a very sunny day. And the only way we could get back to our house, so many roads were closed because of the flood. We had to take a sort of circular drive around. And within 10 minutes, it was a sunny day, passed a golf course, and people were playing golf. And my daughter said, it's so weird, isn't it? I mean, people playing golf, is it nothing has gone wrong? But in fact, most of the city was, streets were closed, bridges were closed, houses had been destroyed, our art museum, our performing arts center, all these essential buildings were destroyed, and people go on with their lives. I think that's human nature. And the best writers about best war writers, when I think of George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia, his incredible book about the Spanish War, Civil War, or Michael Hare's Dispatches, his war about the Vietnam War, the best writers, they all approach the subject from different perspectives, but what they're hoping to give the reader is some sense of what it meant to be alive in that moment, in those dire circumstances. And some people rise to the occasion and act well, and others become war criminals. And hard to know who's going to rise to the occasion and who won't. But I think my job as a writer is to try to tell some of those stories as well as I can, and hope to be as truthful as possible about what it is I experienced, what I witnessed, what I documented, what I tried to bring to a readership.
Mm-hmm. Is literature political for you? And if yes, what does it mean?
Say again?
Is writing literature political for you? And if yes, what it means?
There's always a political component to it, for sure. The funny thing is, though, about, let's take Orwell's Homage to Catalonia. For me, the least interesting parts of that book are where he starts going into the politics, a direct description of what's going on in various meetings on the Republican side. That gets a little bit boring, but what's interesting is when he's just describing the scenes, telling stories. So there's when you're writing about a war, it cannot help but have a political dimension, because it is, as von Clausewitz said, war is the continuation of politics by other means. And so on some level, it is, of course, a largely political affair with bloody consequences, and writers at their best are always cognizant of that and hoping to be fair in their judgments and accurate in their descriptions of what it is they see unfolding before them.
I wanted to read out another fragment. It's page 74. which also relates to your answer that you just gave. Fascism, Russian style, Ukrainians call Russism, a coinage born of code switching and the criminal brutality of this special military operation. Summary executions, rape, deliberate shelling of civilian infrastructure, kidnappings, and forced disappearances all can accelerate the evolution not only of the defensive strategies deployed to stave off more atrocities, but of the very language of the victims, Ukrainian in this case, Little Russian, as sneering Nabokov referred to it. In his biography of Gogol, The Gifted Son of Ukrainians, who chose to write in Russian wisely, Nabokov believed. Which more Ukrainians defended daily in poetry and on the battlefield than Russian forces could annihilate. Now I recall another emigre, my teacher, Joseph Brodsky, who lamented Ukraine's decision to seek independence, warning his former countrymen, you bravehearts, in an unpublished poem that when their time is up and they scratch at their mattresses like dogs, they will forget the flatters of Taras and whisper Pushkin's verses to the air. So literature is political indeed.
Yeah, and it's and that poem by Brodsky, it's of course is a notorious poem, and I take seriously his literary executor's note that he chose not to include it in his collected poems, which is to say, I think that Brodsky fell victim himself to a certain kind of phobia, if you will. And this is a man who had been kicked out of the Soviet Union, and when I was his student, said that he longed to die in Russia. But when the Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet Union dissolved, he didn't go back. And so I sometimes take that the writing of that poem is, you know, we have these impulses, we follow them. A really wise writer at a certain point will say, you know, maybe not a poem to collect. I was just angry, and I hadn't really thought through the consequences of what I was writing. I imagine that was partly what went through his mind. I'm assuming he just decided this isn't up to what he's capable of. It's such an ugly poem that he wrote about Ukraine that it's hard to see your teachers fail in that way, that they would succumb to that. But it's, you know, America's first great poet, Walt Whitman, he wrote a lot of terrible poems too, and poems that just did not survive. I think we can forgive Brodsky's error here because he was smart enough not to publish it. That's the end of that part of the story.
Yeah. Well, I also read a couple of interviews which were given by those people who knew Brodsky intimately, and they always mentioned this poem as some unfortunate event. But yeah, they literally also say something to the fact that, well, I'm more than willing to forgive him for that because
the thing of it is, every decent writer looks back over the work they've written in a lifetime. I've reached that age that I have no choice but to do that, and I think, oh my God, what a terrible thing I wrote there. I mean, what was I thinking? Well, you know, I think that I wasn't thinking as well as I should have. I wasn't interrogating those materials as well as I should have. And I think that Brodsky must have come to think the same thing about what he wrote there, and he just wanted to put it out of his mind that he had written such a poem.
I wanted to also briefly talk about what creates hope for survival and healing. as the atrocities that you describe in The Road to Lviv will have to be healed. And I understand that, first of all, the war has to stop and the perpetrators will have to be punished and the territorial integrity will have to be reconstructed. Are these political events part of the healing process in your opinion? And this question is inspired by your text in which the individual and the collective collide. The political become part of life of those who lost their loved ones.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate summary of what ends up having to happen. First is the careful documentation of what happened. It's as if, I think of sometimes in writing, is you're a little bit like a doctor. You're trying to get an accurate diagnosis, at least in the first drafts of something that you write. In this case, it's the first draft of history, and you understand that you're not going to get every detail correct. You'll miss this. You'll misunderstand that. But an accurate description of that shared reality is essential to any hope of finding a way forward or some sort of healing. There has to be ways to enact justice. There has to be the fighting has to come to an end. There's a wonderful poem that I've always loved by Wisława Szymborska. It goes, after every war, someone has to clean up. And what do you do after the war? I watched all that happen in the Balkans. And remember, I was back in Sarajevo and Mostar in 2001, just before 9/11. And, you know, the wounds were so deep. And to this day, they're still deep. The shrapnel marks in the street and on the buildings were still there. Time will heal some parts of it, but time will also be moved in different directions based on what people write about, right? You know, just imagine how this serves part of the propaganda to get, for Serbs to attack, to launch the war in 1991 was their defeat on the battlefield 600 years before that. And the whole tradition of Serbian epic poetry about that terrible defeat on the field of blackbirds, as they called it. And, you know, that's when you realize, any form of writing can have both healing properties and disastrous consequences, which is why another Polish poet, always in my mind, Czesław Miłosz, and I'm paraphrasing, would say that the poet hopes that good spirits, not evil ones, dictate what he writes. And so, to go back to that Brodsky poem, Ukraine, I think on some level he was so close to Miłosz, I think he realized, the evil spirits dictated the writing of that, so we're just going to put it aside. And you never know at the end whether what you're writing is any good or you hope it's true, you hope it's honest, you hope it's rigorous, you hope your interrogation of the language and the materials is up to snuff. But, you know, we get it wrong. That's the nature of human behavior. And so we look forward to a time where it might be possible to forgive our enemies because they have made their own accounting. They have come to terms with what was done in their names, if not the perpetrators themselves, who will, you know, usually find a way to get off and to survive. But at some point, the fighting will end, and one hopes that good writers will have added to the fabric of knowledge through their careful documentation of what they see. And in this case, it's going to be, of course, Ukrainian writers are the first to do that, and they'll do it in so much more rigorous and moving ways than what I was able to do in this little poem of an outsider witnessing disaster.
Maybe one more question about the poem in general. It is dedicated to Adam Zagajewski, and Would you just tell us a few words about Adam Zagajewski and maybe his role, so to speak, his role in this text?
Well, I have always loved his poems, particularly To Go to the Cove, which was a really important poem for me at a very early age. I also had the good luck to know him a bit and to host him for readings and to see him in action. And he was such a gentleman and of course, terrific writer, friends with people like Miłosz and Brodsky and Derek Walcott and Seamus Heaney. Poets I revere in their different ways for their different qualities of their verse, but there's this scene in this poem where he's giving a reading in the courtyard of the ruins of a medieval castle in Slovenia, and all the poets are sitting. It's a September afternoon. They're sitting under this large chestnut tree, and while Adam is reading in his very gentle voice. Huge chestnuts are falling out of the trees and landing on the heads of the poets. And I happened to be standing at the back, so I was safe from this. And I was watching the poets. They're listening hard to what Adam's reading, but they're also looking up. And it occurred to me, because I don't want to get hit by a chestnut, that it looked a little bit like they were praying. And I thought that it reminded me of that close connection between poetry and prayer. Adam's poems, I think, work in many ways like prayers, and I like to think that poetry at its best is a form of prayer. So this is a sort of prayer for Ukraine in this dark moment.
Well, thank you so much, Christopher. Thank you so much for this conversation today, and thank you for your book On the Road to Lviv, which does record and document the development, the very initial stage of the full-scale invasion that took place in 2022. And the poem does help us better understand the emotional state of those who were in the country and those who were directly impacted by this atrocity. Well, thank you so much for the book.
Thank you. This has been a riveting conversation.
Today I spoke with Christopher Merrill, author of On the Road to Lviv, published by Arrowsmith Press in 2023, and the book was translated in Ukrainian by Nina Murray. Thank you for listening to New Books in Ukrainian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.